Hello and welcome to the Stinging Fly podcast. Every month we ask a writer to choose a piece from our archives to read and discuss. My name is Ian Malini and today I'm joined by Adrian Duncan. Adrian is the Berlin-based author of two novels, Love Notes from a German Building Site, which won the John McGahern Book Prize in 2019, and A Sabbatical in Leipzig. His first collection of short stories, Midfield Dynamo, was published earlier this year by Lilliput Press. Aside from writing, Adrian has also worked as a structural engineer, visual artist, and filmmaker. He is the co-editor of Paper Visual Arts, a contemporary art publication based between Berlin and Dublin. Adrian has chosen to read a piece from the summer 2008 issue of The Stinging Fly, an essay from the First Passion series written by the Longford poet Vona Groark. Vona Groark has published six collections of poetry with the Gallery Press, as well as the book-length essay Four Sides Full. Former editor of the Poetry Ireland Review, Vona's writing has won the Michael Hartnett Award and been shortlisted for the Forward Prize. She currently teaches at the Centre for New Writing at the University of Manchester and is a member of AESTONA. Here's Adrian Duncan reading First Passions, an essay by Vona Groark.
It begins with Catherine Jackson, whose Spring Tales was the first book I remember loving. My sister gave it to me for my birthday when I was 5 or 6, when books were still priced, as this one is, in shillings and pence. I believe it may have been the first book I ever actually owned, small enough to be held nicely in any child's hand. It's a collection of some 50 tiny stories and poems with titles such as Tag Along Lamb, The Strange Case of Mr. Camel, and Snowshoes, the second. One poem still knocks around my head from time to time. It begins, I quote, "Grown-ups have sayings that plain to be seen mean something much different from what they should mean." It was nearly clue that what language said and what it meant could be different entities. Did I, aged 5, come to appreciate the possibilities of irony? I doubt it. But I remember loving the fact that the pieces were seldom longer than 2 pages and that they somehow managed, within that space, to tell full stories with children in them I would have liked to have for friends. And that, despite the hint buried in the poem above, I could understand the words. Brevity, transparency, familiarity. That's how it started, if not quite how it transpired. Best of all, Spring Tales was illustrated by Richard Scarry, with bunnies and dungarees, mice in bonnets and ganders and bicycles. This was a cheerful world. Everything there was brighter, more animated than in so-called real life. As a reader, some 40 years on, I still hope this will be the case when I enter a new book. I value a pleasant magic, characters doing what they ought not to, and all to the good. I think I may have taken to poetry because it had inbuilt shortcuts to the flip side of reality and didn't need to explain itself quite so much as prose. It is something of the power of illustration to present a competing version of the way things are. Fowl on a bicycle, a talking giraffe, that's just how it is, for the moment anyway. As for the next, who knows? Nothing about a single poem can predict the next. I like the white space to the either side of writing that has kicked away its scaffolding and struts. I learned to like small boxes. With care, I noticed you could fit so much in them. It's not such a big step, maybe, from a child's picture book to Lawrence Stern's The Life and Opinions of Tristram Shandy, Gentleman, which was for me, in my mid-teens, the epitome of cool. It was great fun, being both playful and wayward, and it took a story and knotted it tighter and oftener than any other prose epic I'd read. The digressions, asides, and narrative, curlicues, the ribaldry, Latin, asterisks, and dashes, the famous marbled page. If this was how prose could be ruffled, then why, I wondered, would anyone settle for a straightforward linear approach? In its entirety, chapter 7 of book 8 reads, "But for heaven's sake, let us not talk of quarts or gallons. Let us take the story straight before us. It is so nice and intricate a one. It will scarce bear the transportation of a single tittle." and somehow or other, you've got me thrust almost into the middle of it. I beg we may take more care. Tristram Shandy cured me of any urge to write fiction. Stories struck me, in my generous way, as only so much tittle. I began to formulate a desire for writing that wasn't about forward momentum, but was still and dark as lake water, and possibly as cold. My old quarrel with the Soviet dictatorship is wholly unrelated to any question of property. The nostalgia I have been cherishing all these years is a hypertrophied sense of lost childhood, not sorrow for lost banknotes. So wrote Nabokov in Speak, Memory, a book that opened to me a view of language that had been engineered so that the grace of the words and phrases was at least as important as the thrust of the narrative which they were put to serve. It was like looking at a building of extraordinarily complicated architecture and seeing, first and foremost, that its beauty derived from the quality of its materials. I was, and am, stricken by the capacity of the mind that can perceive in a lost inheritance of a white-pillared mansion and 2,000 acres a more significant and resonant loss of that which we all must lose, childhood. And I was, and am, stricken by a language that walks head high into its own melancholic graces. When I read the book in my late teens, I recognised almost nothing of a childhood of valets and governesses, holidays in Wiesbaden and Biarritz, pre-breakfast fencing and wilderness of snow. By then, I didn't want familiarity. I'd already been in and somewhat out of love with the stately, poised and piercing prose of Brideshead Revisited, Thomas Mann, and much of Henry James. I wanted new worlds of language in which nothing of my own childhood could possibly bed down. I wanted to convert my own inheritance, such as it was, into words it wouldn't have recognised and places it never had been. A large alabaster-based kerosene lamp is steered into the gloaming. Gently it floats and comes down the hand of memory, now in a footman's white glove, places it in the centre of a round table. I was in awe of writing that could shift the ground from under me like this, that could work a metaphor so swiftly and neatly. I could hardly see how the trick had been accomplished and how what is speculative, imagined, or construed is made for the reader unflinchingly real. By then I was turning towards poetry, but already I'd learned from Speak, Memory, that shape-shifting and sleight of hand were integral to good writing, that beauty, indeed luxury, of image was permissible, and that language could untether itself from its predictable and utilitarian inheritance with surprising and revelatory stealth. There had to have been collections of poetry, but what I remember is the full-force gale of individual poems. Ozymandias, Hopkins's Terrible Sonnets, Cuba, Marvels, The Garden, Bishops, The Bite, The Whitsun Weddings, I Died for Beauty, Meditations in Time of Civil War, Mahan's, The Woods, Dawn's, A Lecture Upon the Shadow, and The Guttural Muse. It was later before I could recognise what made a book of poems occasionally more than the sum of its parts. By then, I realised how hard it is to make even a single half-good poem. I'm still learning, still reading and rereading, still practicing, and still hoping to come across words that will mean what they say, and then some.
I mean, the first question that I guess we would usually ask here is why you would pick this piece. I'm presuming it's for a reason more substantial than she's also from Longford, as you are.
It's funny. Fiona, I think, is from just down direction, and I'm from Ballymahon. I've never met her, and I've no idea like what she's like or anything like that. I think my father might have known some of her family or something like that, but I don't know who she is, as it were. I'd come across this essay online because I'd been kind of looking into Vona's work for the last, I suppose, maybe 6 or 7 years. And the first book actually that I read, I'd come across some of her poetry, but then I came across this book, Four Sides Full, and I was surprised to see that it wasn't poetry, that it was actually a very lengthy and amazing essay. So that book really caught my eye. I thought it was astonishing, just, you know, without being, I don't mean to mince my words, it is an unbelievable essay. And I started looking into other aspects of her work, and then I picked up the Double Negative, and I started reading the poems in that. And I found them kind of unsettling and deeply, deeply interesting. And I found them very serious as well. But not so serious as to not permit a sort of a wordplay and certain kinds of jokes and certain kinds of unexpected moments of kind of seeming informality, you know. So she just sort of, her work just fascinated me. And then, because I'm not from the world of literature, whenever I go to poetry readings, I am always taken aback, I always find it quite strange how poets read their writing, in that there are a lot of poets that I have seen over the years, and I have listened to them reading their work, and I go, why are you talking like that? It never really quite made sense to me that there was such a sort of kind of a strange performance around their reading. So then I started looking at some of Vona's readings just to see what the cut of her was when she was reading, to see if I'd like the way she read or not. And to my relief, I saw some readings she did in Trinity College, I think, a couple of years ago. And she read exactly in the way that I would like to see readings done, i.e. almost completely, with just allowing the words to appear, kind of getting out of the way of the words kind of thing, you know? Mm. Because I really liked her work, and I was like, oh, please don't be someone whose readings I actually enjoy. It's not that big of a problem, but it's all part of the thing. And I actually really enjoyed the way she read as well. So that was kind of, those kind of three or four bits and pieces that kind of drew me to her. And then this essay, there are these moments in it that I just found extremely interesting. That's how I kind of got drawn towards her work. Of course, like in Longford when I was growing up, she was kind of quite well known because she was really successful. Because I suppose poetry is one thing, and being, a novelist is a slightly different thing in the eyes of people who are not necessarily working in the literary industry, which none of my family were. So you're aware of their being very well sort of established and being very successful and being very important. But because they're poets, you can't really share in that as much as, say, how you can talk about, a short story or a novel. You know, there's something slightly apart, you know, which is very interesting. Those are the kind of things. She was always kind of hovering there in the mid-distance from me when I was growing up.
Yeah, I guess I would have had something similar with Marina Carr at one point. You know, again, because it's theatre maybe, and because of the subject matter, not exactly dinner table conversation in the farmhouses of County Offaly, but nonetheless... middle distance is a good example, a good way of putting it, I think. this piece, obviously, it's called First Passions. I think, you know, it's part of a series that The Singing Fly was doing at the time, where people were writing about the books that sort of made an impression upon them as children, I suppose, and were this kind of the spark of the writerly instinct in people and where they might trace that back to. And what struck me about reading this one, I think particularly, was that there is the beautiful line in the middle of it. I began to formulate a desire for writing that wasn't about forward momentum, but was still and dark as lake water and possibly as cold. I mean, it's a beautiful line by itself, but it also kind of points to that first spark of attraction to writing being in the language rather than the story. And there's multiple points like that, I think, within the piece. And was that something that resonated with you, or something that you found interesting in the way that she was talking about this? Because I think obviously when you're a kid, a lot of the time the focus tends to be on the plot and the story and being kind of caught up in this world. But here it's something a little bit different to that, I think.
Yeah. And I think for me, there's two moments. There's two moments. That moment that you point on there was one that definitely caught my eye, apart from the fact because the sentence is so beautiful. But also, it definitely sort of talks about the directions, you know, the sort of the, let's say, if you were thinking about it as the vectors, let's say, of movement, or the vectors of force, let's say, and how they're slightly different compared to, say, a novel, or let's say a poem, that like there is a certain horizontality to a novel. Let's say it's moving, you know, it's moving along. Sometimes it can drop and drop into depths, but it has to kick on again fairly soon, if that, into its pace, whatever that pace is. But poems, of course, seem to me to be very, very different. And there's actually, in relation to this, there are there are two points that, like, if I could just pivot back from that point that you've made there on that moment where I began to formulate a desire for it that wasn't about forward momentum, but was still and dark as lake water and possibly as cold. So there's two poems that I'd like to sort of just kind of move into. I'd like to read them. But another moment that I would like to just point to in this is this idea of the power of illustration. It had something of the power of illustration to present a competing version of the way things are. To me, those kind of two points are either side of the same thought. They seem to feel like they belong together. When I read that, if I can just pop back to this idea of the power of illustration, I was just thinking of how like images appear in poetry, and particularly say in Vaughan's poetry, but also then in literature. And I was thinking about this conversation that John Berger had a number of years ago I think it was Susan Sontag, and they were talking about movement in a novel or in a piece of fiction. Mm. And Berger used the analogy, he was talking about that there's a kind of moving from paragraph to paragraph. It's not a sort of a continuousness, or it doesn't have to be, but there's a sort of montage that goes on where you can like stop, and then in the next paragraph, you know, you can go from being inside, and in the next paragraph, you know, you're in a car. So there's a break in the continuum, but the reader gets on with it and they understand. It's like in film, you know, you cut to another view. And I found that really interesting because I'm sure if you were like, say, studying literature, that would seem like a very obvious thing. But to me, at the time when I heard it, I was like, oh, yeah, that's really interesting. And it is a bit like film. Now, of course, there's lots of novels that don't do that, but that is something that is kind of can happen in novels. And then there's a poem then that I'd like to do is just to kind of draw that distinction out. There's a poem called Against Rancour, and I'll just read it here. And this is from Double Negative. A car ascending the back of the hill pushes a cart of light in which all manner of gewgaws, such as aeroplanes and stars, rattle above the little noise of keyholes and doors not fully closed and curtains that can't bring themselves to meet. Which is where I put you with your back to me, clocking how one panel of darkness slides back to let the village pass through the eye of night, how it is rammed shut again as the car tips over the tipping point down into Hill Street as you turn back to your lit room and all our lives go on. To me, there's a sort of a... There are breaks when there's a full stop and there's a semicolon, then there's a full stop. That's the only sort of punctuation in the poem. But this thing of a car ascending the back of the hill, pushing a cart of light, and then aeroplanes and stars, and then rattle above the little noise of keyholes and doors not fully closed and curtains that can't bring themselves to meet. That to me is a sort of such a different visual space to, not just in terms of the order in which the things have been given, but also the fact that they actually, that there's a sort of a continuum, that there's almost like it's a topological surface that you're moving around, and that the poem, the lettering, the words in the poem is the sort of surface, is that kind of curved and continuous surface. It's almost like, you know, those kind of Mobius strips where if you move along your finger along the edge, you end up at the other side of the, magically, when you, if you move along far enough, you end up on the other side of the strip of paper. That to me is what these, what the, what a sort of an image experience in that poem feels like. And it just seems so far away from that kind of, that idea of montage in fiction, let's say, or in prose. And it's just that idea then, so I just, this idea of power, the power of the, of illustration to present a competing version of the way things are, that to me just seems in these, in the poems that, against Rancor, that just seems to me really, like really, really strong. And then also that moment, just going back to the moment that you picked out, there was another poem that I kind of highlighted, and it's against, I'll just read it again, it's slightly different issue. It's not about the imagistic aspects, but about just something slightly different. I'm just going to read it through. And it's called, yeah, Against Sorrow. These are short poems, but they're extremely powerful. So here's Against Sorrow. It's slightly earlier in the book. Behind the rain knotting silver wool into streamers out the back, and before an ocean laying down the law as ever, in the front is me in an opera of silence in a borrowed light blue room, all my intervals done with the curtains tightly drawn. Yeah, I think that line, as a in front of me is an opera, in the front is me in an opera of silence in a borrowed light blue room. Like that kind of a line there, an opera of silence, is just, there's just something sort of utterly unexpected and plungingly real about it, you know? And I just thought it was, that was another moment in the, like where this essay kind of triggered thoughts that I'd had on the poems, where you're kind of brought to kind of very, very strange depths by the poem. It's almost as if you're kind of falling down into some sort of inverted cone, you know, with the language. Those are the kind of, I don't know, it's kind of hard to talk about because I'm not skilled in talking about poetry, but all I can do is kind of just sort of point to these moments that are that seem to me to have a sort of a power in them that are kind of almost completely out of scale to the number of words that are being used in them, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's also, I mean, you mentioned the horizontality of a novel. Like these poems, the way that they're written, the way that they appear on the page, which I gather is very important to Fiona's work. They have a verticality in the way that they are on the page and the way that the lines are broken and the way that even that the words, listening to you read them, they fall into each other. And sometimes they climb a little bit too. And, you know, there does seem to be an up and down motion in it, which is... as you said, quite different to a story or even an essay that has, I guess, an endpoint in mind, has markers that it needs to hit, I suppose. And I think it's very interesting that you bring up film as well, because obviously there is a school of filmmaking which very much is about being drawn to particular images and being sort of discarding the idea of moving forward in the way that a Hollywood film might. There are loads of examples of that, but where the cut doesn't do the thing that it does in the traditional montage, I think that's like, it's a really fascinating thing. And to bring this into the writing, it's telling, I think, that in both cases, it is the focus on a compelling image, an image that won't leave you, and that you have to sort of just roam over again and again until you sort of have come to terms with it in some way. That seems to be what's going on here.
And I think also, like, with, say, for instance, in the Against Rancor, the first one that I read, the just the way in which because each sort of each two lines, each couplet, I suppose, number of them bring very, very, very strong images. A cart of light, like a car sending a back of a hill, pushing a cart of light. Keyholes and doors not fully closed. I mean, the sort of movement that you're being asked to do as a reader is not of this world. So, like, you're being asked to see and you're being asked to kind of hear and sense. But it's almost as if there's a sort of an impossibility, like a sort of an impossible sense of scale between each sort of two lines, and that just the sort of rhythm of the poem and the sort of happy interpenetrating of the senses of the images, that's what gets you through to it. Instead of you just going, "How is this happening?" you're just sort of carried through on it. Because if you were to sort of try to describe what's happening in the poem, you know, no one would believe that such a thing would be A, worth doing or possible to do. But yet, when you're reading that poem like that, you're just being moved gently along into these sort of sensations. And even if it just amounted to that, you know, if you just took that as the fundamental thing that you took from the poem, that I was moved along these variety of sensations, like, that to me would be enough. But of course, there's so many other things going on as well in the poem. And I think there's an awful lot of biographical aspects to it as well. But there's also, like, lots of really interesting wordplay. And I love the way she uses what seemed to me to be sort of Longford localisms. like, there's in one poem, she used the word "the glad eye." Mm. And then she used the word "clocking," how one panel of darkness slides back to let the village pass. I don't know, clocking down where I'm from anyway is like, you know, you got clocked, you got seen. And I think, and I'm not sure if that, meaning is, say, as available in other parts of the world, but it still works in the poem, because it can have a meaning of, say, measuring, or have a meaning of, you know, speeding or whatever. There's loads of other different meanings to it. But I like that my first meaning that I took from that clocking was seeing, like actually noticing or recognizing. Mm. And it didn't neither, and I've kind of gone through the poem thinking of it from the word clocking and the different variations that it could mean. And it changes the colour of the poem from there on, but none of which are, none of these varieties of meaning at that moment destabilise, or, like, say, none of them sort of tip over or crush out the other possible meanings. Mm. There's something going on there that's just, yeah, it's just very, very, it's just, to me, it's just very, very mysterious. And because I don't write poetry, and, like, I haven't tried to write poetry in years, it just sort of stuns me whenever I do come across this kind of stuff. It just, because it's not my everyday reading experience, that I'm just like completely shuddered out of my usual experiences.
There's a sort of an unsettling quality to them, I think. Not in the sense that you are afraid or anything like that. It's just like something in you as you read them begins to shift a little bit and finds a new sort of balance that you don't often maybe achieve, and things are therefore unsettled from where they normally are. And you can definitely pick that up, I think, from the poems that you've read here.
I know. And the thing is, like, in that sentence, she says, "still and dark as lake water." And then the last clause in that is, "and possibly as cold." I mean, that is such a strange thing to sort of say. You know, I began to formulate a desire for writing that wasn't about forward momentum, but was still and dark as lake water and possibly as cold. I mean, there's something extra there, you know.
Yeah. Even in the piece that, or the quote that she pulls out from Speak Memory, I think you can really, you can see the influence in a way. When you put the two together like this, I think you can see the connection very strongly between the poetry that she's writing and this sentence, which is obviously prose, but I guess Nabokov's prose is his own. You know, a large alabaster-based kerosene lamp is steered into the gloaming. Like, that's a little bit different from traditional narrative writing as well. Gently it floats, comes down, the hand of memory, now in a footman's white glove, places in the center of a round table. That's a little bit more as well. There's something going on there which is slippery, and like, you can read it, but at the same time you get the sense that there's much more going on in it than a cursory read would give you, you know?
Yeah, this is something that I find really interesting in any kind of writing, really, is that the sort of the layers of meaning that are, and how they are allowed to exist relative to a sort of, let's say, a literal meaning to a story, to a sentence. And I actually think that the literal meaning of a sentence is kind of there's something kind of absolutely amazing, the fact that you know, you kind of lose sight of the fact that, you know, out of 24 letters, we've managed to to produce words and transmit ideas and things like this. I mean, there's something kind of completely miraculous about it. So I think the literal meaning is amazing. But then I'm always really, really interested in when the other kind of possible meanings that can exist. And I think poetry, you expect that, you know. And I think in prose, you half expect it, you know. Mm. But I'm always really, really interested in the way in which I think there's actually an aesthetics in how the other layers of meaning can possibly sort of rest upon or fall upon, say, the most, you could say the most intended meaning, or you could say the most possibly or most likely to be interpreted meaning. And I love when there's like a sort of, it's almost as if it's like, you know, it's almost as if a sort of like a shaken out a sheet and some dust falls on it after the sheet itself has kind of stopped being shook. I always think of that, those secondary meanings, as being similar to that kind of effect. And like in that poem, again, we'll move on from it, but that poem, I think it was Against Rancor with the clocking. Mm. I had an awful lot of fun sort of just letting that word play out in that poem, even though the poem itself feels quite sad and quite sort of, you know, there's a sort of lonesomeness to it. But I find that there's still... you're still allowed, and this is why I really admire the work, is because even though some of the work might be kind of, let's say, the mood might be, say, one of, you know, tinged with sadness or something like that, or maybe loss or sort of regret or whatever, that doesn't compound, or it doesn't remove the possibility for actually quite for play within the reading of the piece as well. And I really admire that in an artist, if they allow that room in their work, you know.
Definitely. I mean, that's, I guess it's something, like you say, you expect in poetry. I mean, this is what good poetry, we're taught, does. You know, it has this multiplicity of meaning. You get a sense of falling through the words, you know, into what maybe is underneath them, that all of the stuff that we bring with ourselves into the poem, that allows that sort of echo of an individual word or an individual phrase, which may, in hopefully, in some sense, mirror or at least resonate with the many senses of the poet as they're bringing into it, and the images that they're bringing into it, that things that have compelled them to do this thing that we call poetry, which is, like you say, not something that makes any sense at all really to do, but is nonetheless extremely valuable and powerful, perhaps for that reason. So
yeah, and as I say into it, like in the last couple of, you know, the last few weeks when I've kind of been returning to this, it's been, I've kind of gone, oh yeah, geez, I should read way more poetry than I do. just this idea, you mentioned like the actual, you were talking about a few moments ago about the actual physical shape of the poem on the page. The actual shape, the poem and the not poem part of the page, and how the not poem part of the page becomes a sort of frame for the poem. Mm-hmm. So the white around the poem. This seems to be something to me that's of great interest to Vona. And I'll just go to the line in the essay. I liked the white space to either side of writing that has kicked away its scaffolding and struts. I learned to like small boxes. With care, I noticed you could fit so much in them. So there's a book then, this is the 2016 work, and it's called Four Sides Full. And it's about frames, kind of painfully simple. It's about frames, picture frames. It's about the type of picture frames that you can see on paintings, on photographs. It seems to me to be, it's about 100 pages, this book, and it's quite scholarly in terms of the degree of research that has gone into different, you know, the different uses of frames, mounting boards, different names for frames, quotes from different modern painters over the years, from mainland Europe or whatever, describing their relationship with the frame, how the frame has changed, all this kind of stuff. And the parts then, as the kind of essay progresses, other types of frames started becoming appearing. So one of the frames is, say, your house, the house that you live in, or the home that you were brought up in, certain rooms. Then the body, the actual physical body, is talked about as a frame in the book. The family, one's family growing up, and then one's family that one might make later in one's life. And also the idea that if you have children, then your body is a frame for these children coming into being. So what I really love about it is that it stays at once really focused on the subject in hand. Yet it seems to produce aspects onto this subject that are still very focused, but are multiple and utterly surprising, and go to places on a personal register, but also on a kind of a sort of on a research / intellectual level that are extremely surprising. The intellectual aspects are just like, I would never have thought of that, and I'd never heard of that. You know, kind of educational stuff, and then some of the personal stuff is just utterly moving. I mean, utterly, utterly moving, and not because it's trying to be moving; it's because the work needed the writing to go to that personal place for the work to be better. That's what it feels like to me, you know. So the sort of book then starts appearing to be a sort of a reframing of oneself. And I suppose when you think about personal essays, and you'll be able to obviously talk about this an awful lot more, you've written essays more so than I, but that I always think of essays as being, I always have kind of a few things, is that an essay is a sort of, particularly a personal essay, is a sort of reframing of yourself as the writing is going on in the work. But that also, that what's been looked at, I always feel, and I got this first whenever I started reading Michel de Montaigne's work, was that there was a subject at hand, but that as the essay proceeded, that there were lamps appearing around the work that were going on and going off as the essay progressed. And through this experience of viewing this thing under these changing lamps and changing directions of light, that you learn something more about it. Whether that more was of any use or not didn't really matter, but you just learned more about it. Or you learned even that the idea was just far more complex than you had thought in the first case. Mm-hmm. And the other thing then that I also feel whenever I'm reading someone else's nonfiction is that, do I trust them? You know, this is a really, mm-hmm. really big yeah. thing. And I liken this aspect of, do I trust them, to like almost a sense of smell. And it's kind of really bad, because if I feel for a moment that I don't trust a nonfiction writer, so someone is presenting something as nonfiction or an essay, and if I feel for a moment that there's something fishy, whether it be an intellectual jump or whether it be something that I just don't believe, that there ends my association with that writer. it is almost that bad. It is, I have a very, very extreme reaction to it. But all the way throughout this book, Four Sides Full, I just came out the end of it kind of going, just with a kind of an even greater admiration for the work.
Do you want to read a small part of it, or is there a part that you'd like to maybe focus on?
For sure. There's a section early, and this is a section early in it, and it's about 15 pages in or so. I'll read this section. It's about page and a half, but it's just amazing. So it's there's two paragraphs. So it's broken up into these kind of paragraphs. So I'll read one, and then the first one is short enough, and then the second one is a little bit longer. So life. A word in which three of the letters seem to agree on a direction and the fourth has other ideas. It is practically silent, that E, a stowaway sheltering in the lee of the other ones. Three sides of a frame that occupy a vertical world, that see the world along the same more or less straight up lines, and a fourth that curls round a protected space as any life requires. I was maybe six or seven, filling in the stretch between home from school and tea time, I was playing outside. My mother was big on us playing outside. Not outside in a Heathcliff and Cathy sort of way, untamed hills and folds of fields you could get lost in or encounter fairies or come back from centuries having passed, a different child entirely. No, outside had to be in view of the kitchen window or the back door or, at a push, outside the front door, hitting a tennis ball against the gable wall so she'd hear us within reach. I was probably larking with our old dog, Judy, or doing my best to annoy my brother, but either way, I'd have been lonely and bored, as I mostly remember being. I think I'd not yet learned to find in books the company I so badly wanted for real. I remember a lot of loitering, looking in windows of bedrooms, wondering if anything would be different seen from outside in, or if I'd catch anyone up to something, as if there were anyone to catch. But I did eke out a mystery all the same. Not something happening inside rooms, but in the rooms themselves. The windows had something wrong with them. Something didn't add up. From the inside, the wall of the bedroom where I slept seemed to be mostly window. Likewise, the room to the left of it, closest to the kitchen. These two big windows would surely have brushed almost against each other had there not been a dividing wall. Seen from the outside, however, there was a sizable portion of wall separating them. I got my mother's measuring tape from the old Singer sewing machine. I tried to make them tally, the inside and the out, but I couldn't. There was only one possible explanation. There had to be a secret, windowless room separating the two big windows, accounting for the stretch of unaccountable pebble dash. I asked my mother what she kept in the secret room, and when she told me there was no secret room, I knew its contents had to be very important indeed. But what could be so secret that it had to be locked in a hidden room that my mother said didn't exist? I remember at one stage being pretty sure that it must have been another child, a very quiet child, a better child than I, a child to be sheltered from the kind of sister who failed every day to come rescue her. These are the kinds of knots bored children tie up their lives in, complicated knots that double back on themselves and can't be undone, even with diagrams, even with the step-by-step account of how they came to be. The secret room with the better me. The secret room with another life so precious it had to be protected from me. And I was only 6 or 7. Oh, you can be very sure I filled that room with the most fanciful content known to a Midland youngest child who watched a lot of TV. I imagined it based on the logic of the measuring tape, narrow, taller than it was wide, lit with exuberant chandeliers sometimes and, other times, blacker than the inside of my mouth in the small hours, fast asleep. I imagined it filled with precious jewels and also filled with feathers or lightning or with a strange and eerie greyness, with no memory of colour or light. I imagined it where the witch lived, when she wasn't underneath my bed, waiting to grab my ankles. I imagined it New York, where my mother and her stories came from. It was a lab where gold was made by a man in a white coat who would not speak, and it was where my new friends were waiting for me, ready to jump out and call, surprise. Later on, when I first walked into an art gallery in Dublin, I saw, in all those high gilt frames, the inside of that room. And it was like nothing I'd imagined. And it was like it all. But when I was reading that, I kept on thinking of a friend of mine called Carl Burke. He's an Irish artist, and I suppose you could call him maybe a sound artist as well. There are two works of his that I kept thinking of, and one of them was a sound work called Omnipresent, and it was basically made up of three box speakers that I set up. It was when Emma were down in Newman House down in UCD, or the old grounds of UCD in the centre of town, and it was three box speakers that would emit a sort of a low sound that were just about, you could feel on your ear, you could just about register. And so you could walk around this room with these three boxes, creating a sort of triangulation of sort of surges, continuous surge of sort of low frequency sound. And what was really fascinating about it was that when you were walking around this, you were getting this sound, but then there were little pockets in the room where the sound meeting each other cancelled. and there was just silence. And you would stand in this little pocket, registering nothing or no sound relative to what you just stepped from. And then you would step 2 or 3 yards to your left or right or front or back, and then the sound would start coming back into your ears. And it was like you were being made aware of yourself in a way through a sense that you don't normally use. So that was one work, and I think it's a beautiful work, and it's a work that reminded me of that came into my mind when I was reading Vona's piece there. That kind of dark soundlessness of these pockets of framed silence, you know, silence framed with sound. And then there was another work that of Carl's, again, you refer to him as an artist, but I actually think he's kind of like a philosopher of space, you know. He just uses strange arts. He just uses materials that look like things you would see in an art gallery. But there's another work that he made in the Hugh Lane Gallery, I think it was 2012, and it was called Arrangements. And it's basically a series of frames, large steel and sometimes timber frames. But I remember one day he was putting into one of the, it was the first floor in the Hugh Lane Gallery, and it was filled with some works from the collection. Agnes Martin, I think, was in there. And then, you know, an old painting for like maybe say, the middle of the 1800s with big gilt frames on them, you know, as well. Mm. But Carl's piece was basically two steel frames about maybe 8 foot tall and about maybe 10 feet, 12 feet long. And I remember he rang me during the day because I was living in Dublin at the time, and he just said, can you come up? I need a bit of a hand here with this. And I was like, okay, yeah. So I came up and he was doing a trial frame in timber. And basically the frame was of black. He painted it black timber. And it was coming out from the edge. So there's two doors into this space. And the frame was coming out as a sort of horizontal rectangle out from the side of the door open. So when you were walking through this door, to your right-hand side, this steel frame would sort of guide you along. Open steel frame. And his big problem at the time was, should the steel frame run up to the top of the architrave, or should it just run to where the door opening stops? And this became a topic of conversation between he and I for about an hour, the merits and problems of, does this frame meet the door open, or does it meet the architrave, the architectural flourish? And I'm pretty sure we decided at the time, or ultimately Carl decided, that it would just run to the door open, that the architectural flourish would be outside the scope of the frame, let's say. And then I remember a couple of months later, the show was on. It was like it was an Arts Council funded show. And I went up there and there were two older men in the space, and they were walking in and out through these frames, walking like through these steel frames, because you could, it was easy. You wouldn't disturb them, or you could just look at them or whatever. And I just thought that there was something really deeply interesting about that aspect of their engagement with it. That at once, these frames are things that are sitting in the space. You can't see both of them at the same time. It's framing a sort of other artworks, but it's also just framing air or bringing your attention to a slice of air. And there's all these things that could be done in a kind of, say, almost like a Cartesian experimental way. But then also, they're like playthings for people to just walk through and have that experience of going through a threshold in and out of what, who knows. And I remember at the time that you could talk about these works then in these terms. You could talk about them as, you know, just things framing slices of air, or things framing other things, or things that people can play with. Or you can also talk about them in a lineage of art history in terms of, you know, them being objects within a sort of tradition of minimalism or that kind of thing. Or say, artworks where there's a sort of a public negotiation or a public sort of activation with them. And this is, so these works came into my mind when I was reading this aspect, this part, this section of Vona's work. But it also brought into my mind the idea that we were talking about earlier on, of what it's saying at least, and then what it's also saying, you know. Mm. This is something that happens throughout this essay, but I really thought in this piece, in this space that might not exist and might just actually be an incorrect measurement by a young girl, that out of this nothingness appears all of these kind of well, essentially riches, you know, and speculations and anxieties, you know. And I just thought of it as a kind of a model almost, or a sort of a, yeah, almost like a model for what it is that that someone who's creating does, you know. There's one last thing then that I'd like to read, it's the very first poem in Double Negative, and I just felt when I was reading through all this work again that it kind of, for me, it sort of brings together a lot of these aspects that we've been talking about to a certain degree, and I'm not trying to utilize the poem to bring anything together. It just felt like that there were resonances in it to me. It's interesting, actually, and I only noticed this. I don't know if this is something that poets do or if it's a thing that's been done before, but in this book, in the Double Negative, some of the poems have got, you know, two capital letters, and you can see that that is the title of the poem. And then there are some titles where the first letter is capitalized, but the rest of the letters are not capitalized, they're just small letters. And then you realize that that this title is actually doubling as the first line of the poem. So you find yourself, I found myself having to kind of reread a number of poems, realizing that, you know, the first line both title and first line. And I just love that kind of the space that opens up between the notional title and, you know, in inverted commas, the rest of the poem. It's really nice. No one uses doilies anymore, so why do I hold the word to the window so the holes in the pattern are years ago and a visitor has come? Impossible to talk of the mart or Qatar as though days, clumps and clods of them could be glamoured by a paper doily placed nicely on a plate. Here, so, for this poem only, in its wheel of stars and star-shaped flowers, an inkling of words as ornament, the way stars and, yes, flowers are.
That's all for this episode of the Stinging Fly Podcast. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. If you did, we'd really appreciate if you could share it with someone else who might also enjoy it. Thanks to Adrian for being so generous in his reading, and to the Arts Council for supporting our work and making this podcast possible. Catch you next time.